Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impulga in Washington.
This year was the reaffirmation for reforms, because it appears the reforms they've been calling for have not been moving as speedily as they wanted. So there is a renewed call for immediate reforms at the UN Security Council. So that has been the overarching theme for today, just like in previous days.
That's VOA's Peter Kilote on what most African leaders had to say at the UN General Assembly in New York.
Across Sudan, women are dying from pregnancy or childbirth-related complications, whether or not those pregnancies are a result of gender-based violence, or whatever. Women are not getting the standard care that saves your life and saves the life of your child during childbirth.
The United Nations agency that focuses on women's rights and social progress accuses Sudan's warring parties of using sexual violence as a weapon of war.
The value of a currency is the derivative of the productive capacity of the country. So in any case, you cannot have a stable currency if you do not have a stable economy.
And Zimbabwe's currency plunges after central bank move to allow more flexibility. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. This week, heads of state and government gathered at UN headquarters in New York with calls by African leaders for equitable representation on UN Security Council gaining momentum. VOA's Peter Kilote was there and joins us now.
Hi, Peter. What were the highlights today at the United Nations General Assembly?
Thank you very much, Douglas. A lot of the issues are some. You had some representatives of governments from Africa. You had the Ugandan Prime Minister talking today. You had the Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Lesotho, Eswatini, basically talking about multilateralism, talking about reforms at the UN Security Council. It was as if it's, this year was the reaffirmation pushing harder for reforms, because it appears the reforms they've been calling for have not been moving as speedily as they wanted. So there is a renewed call for immediate reforms at the UN Security Council. So that has been the overarching theme for today, just like in previous days, Douglas.
And talking of reforms, many leaders who spoke actually hinted about the demand for a permanent African representation on the United Nations Security Council.
Indeed, they want all the privileges that come with two permanent seats on the UN Security Council, including the veto powers that the five permanent seat holders of the UN Security Council have. There have been suggestions that Africa should indeed have two, but not have all the privileges. And Africa is saying no. Criticisms sometimes have been leveled against China because Africa stood, they said, solidly behind China to gain access to having a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. Then they are wondering why China is not giving its backing or strong backing to have Africa have two permanent seats on the UN Security Council. The question some people are asking was, why shouldn't Africa go first with one single seat with all privileges and then come back to fight another day? But, people are saying also that, well, Africa has been at this for a long time, so why not, grab what you can when you can and when the terrain is favorable? Why go for a lower number when you can have access to two? And that Africa has one of the biggest populations in the world, so why not two? So those are some of the conversations being had here in the corridors at the UN headquarters here in New York.
You have talked to several leaders from across the continent in Africa. Could you tell us some of those and what they had on their mind?
Well, for the president of Namibia, Dr. Nangolo Bumba, he is of the view that the global financial architecture must be immediately addressed, because he argues that when Africans go to borrow, because they are poor, so to speak, and developing country, the ratings are that they will not have money to pay back their loans, so the interest rates are higher. When Western or richer nations go to borrow, their rates are lower. And he said that is not fair, because then you put Africans perpetually in a hole that they cannot fill up. He said there has to be reforms. If you are borrowing at the same rate, we should borrow at the same rate and not an unequal footing. The president of Kenya, William Ruto, echoed similar sentiment. And other leaders that I spoke with, including Ivo Ichiko, who is one of the billionaires from South Africa, who is also the head or the chairman of the Ichikowis Family Foundation, also spoke about a survey conducted by his organization where Africans are calling on African leaders to be brave and to push and be assertive on the international stage so their agenda can also be set and not be influenced by global powers. Because the youth survey, the findings show that first is China with over 76% of influence, followed by the U.S. with 70%. Russia is coming up, but not reading at that higher level. So they were saying that although they are saying external influence on African leaders should be assertive and ensure that the agenda is also adhered to on the global stage, Douglas.
Finally, Peter, the issue of conflict on the continent, especially Sudan, how was it received at the UN General Assembly?
There seemed to be an overwhelming majority of speeches, and then on the sidelines as well, meetings being held. People are calling for immediate cessation of hostilities, and that these guys are destroying their country. They need to find a peaceful settlement to resolving the ongoing conflict, which has had a telling effect on, you know, innocent unarmed civilians, particularly women and children who are caught in the crossfire. They have been significantly displaced across the country, and they are calling for the immediate cessation of hostilities. President Biden mentioned it and said that, you know, peace must prevail. They must end the war now. General Burhan was here at the United Nations to deliver a speech on, you know, on behalf of Sudan. And people during the press conference were calling on him to end the war and find a way of ending the war in Sudan to ensure that peace is restored. So these are some of the issues that have been going on here about Sudan, Douglas.
As you just heard, Peter Klote has been at the UN General Assembly this week in New York. While there, he sat down for an interview with Namibian President Nangolo Mbumba. In this excerpt from their conversation, they start by discussing Mbumba's message to the members of the UN.
The overall message is what we have been doing this whole week, that we should, all of us, as leaders of our respective countries, come together, realize the situation in which we are. The world is not healthy, and therefore we need to come together. We really need to have understanding that we either do things together, achieve, or if we don't come together, no nation by itself alone will be able to solve all the world problems. Therefore, the emphasis on multilateralism, working together, and also that we should also aim to develop all the countries. We can't have prosperous countries on one side and countries where everybody is suffering. No hospitals, no education, not even in some cases, no food. That cannot be the world we want to live in. And the destructive nature of some countries, they want their way. They are invading other countries. They are punishing other countries without doing anything. They are invading other countries and taking their minerals. Those are not the things we should tolerate as leaders.
Where does Namibia stand on the call for reforms of the global financial architecture?
Now, that's exactly what we are talking about. because these institutions were created by those who have won World War II. And it is in their favor. The leadership is divided. Either one is heading the European, is headed by an European, the other one by the American. There is no democracy in that thing. None whatsoever. The other thing is we are members of those institutions. When we go there, we need some money to develop our countries, to make sure that we have medicine for our hospitals. You borrow. But why should I, coming from a small country with 3.3 million people, borrow the same amount, let's say 100 million US, and my interest is higher than Switzerland, than America, than Norway? Why should it be that way? Because then you already from the beginning, they suspect that I will not be able to pay back the money. And therefore, the interest should already be high. So that kind of relationship cannot be tolerated. We can't talk about mutual understanding and moving in the same direction when that is those are the practices. The practices are terrible. It penalizes small countries. It penalizes developing countries. It penalizes poor countries. It penalizes those who need those resources the most.
Talking about reforms at the UN Security Council, a lot of Africans have been pushing for it. Where does the administration in Windhoek stand?
By history, when the Group of Ten was created on the African continent to push for the reform of the Security Council, Namibia already from the beginning was one of them. My predecessor started that. Okay? And the aim was always, we were not thinking about reforming the Security Council in terms of other regions. Ours was specifically that we need two members of the Security Council with all the privileges of permanent members of the Security Council, veto power and other things. And as soon as the Africans start demanding that the whole African continent is not represented, other regions start now jumping in. Asia want to come in, but although they are represented by China, Latin America, rightly, they don't have a member. They want to come in. Other bigger countries in Europe, they want to come in, although they are represented already by Britain and France and Russia. So that has been our situation. But now we have done some push and pull. They are talking about, even the Americans are talking about, no, Africa should be allowed to have two permanent members of the Security Council.
That was Nangolo Mbumba, the president of Namibia. He was speaking with Nelden Africa's Peter Kilote. For more on the UN General Assembly, check out voaafrica.com, voanews.com, and find us on Facebook and Instagram. This week at UN meetings in New York, the US said two African countries should have permanent seats on one of the world's major decision-making bodies, the United Nations Security Council. Kate Bartlett spoke to African analysts about this proposal and whether it's an attempt to score points for Washington in its competition with Beijing on the continent.
For years, numerous African leaders have called for the continent to have representation on the UN Security Council, which since World War II has had just five permanent members, the US, France, the UK, Russia, and China. This week, the top representative of one of those permanent seats, US President Joe Biden, threw his weight behind the idea. However, there was one major caveat, which Kenyan analyst Cliff Mboya said is not going over well on the continent. The new African members would not have veto power on decisions.
We are already seeing a lot of backlash, like this is a big joke. The question is, what is the point of joining the Security Council if you don't have veto powers? What are you going to do there?
That could play in China's favor, as it has long positioned itself as a fellow developing country and leader of what's become known as the Global South, while disparaging the West for its colonial past, said Mboya, a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Africa-China Studies at the University of Johannesburg.
So I don't think this helps the US and the West in terms of perception and narratives. And it will only embolden African countries to lean more to the East, because it just speaks to the hypocrisy. China has been able to build this coalition of emerging and developing countries against the US Western-led world order.
But Paul Nantulia, a research associate with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, said he thought the announcement was a win for US diplomacy and would mostly be welcomed by African nations as it opens the door to further negotiations.
Regarding China, China has been very, you know, kind of like sitting on the fence. So rhetorically, China has said all the right things, supporting Africa, supporting Africa's, what it calls Africa's legitimate interest in the United Nations, including the United Nations Security Council.
But its plan for that has been hazy, he said.
But when it comes to specific details, in terms of whether China supports permanent African representation on the council with veto power, when it comes to that, China has not articulated a position.
Among those in New York this week calling for UN reform was South African President Cyril Ramaphosa. He said, quote, Africa and its 1.4 billion people remain excluded from its key decision-making structures. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also called for reform, saying the UNSC hasn't kept up with the changing world and Africa is underrepresented. Some African countries want veto power in the Security Council disposed of entirely. If there is reform and Africa gets the two seats on the Security Council that the US proposes, key contenders could include the continent's largest economy, South Africa, most populous country, Nigeria, or North African heavyweight, Egypt, Nantulia told VOA. However, analysts say any future process of adding African countries as permanent members is likely to face hurdles, as there will be problems reaching consensus. Nantulia said some African politicians think it could even drive a wedge between countries on the continent. There are also concerns the US statement could just be rhetoric, and so far no timeline has been given regarding the next steps. Under UN rules, any changes to Security Council membership would need approval from two-thirds of the General Assembly, including all five permanent members. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe's gold-backed currency plunged 44% Friday on the official market, the first time since its introduction in April. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
The sudden drop of Zimbabwe's gold-backed currency, or ZiG, began Friday, shortly after the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe's Monetary Committee met and Bank Governor John Mushawane said that after looking at the recent macroeconomic and financial developments and economic outlook, it was ready to allow greater exchange rate flexibility in line with the increased demand for foreign currency in the economy. Immediately after that, ZiG started trading at 25 to 1 US dollar, down from 14 where it has been since April. Tapiwa Mpandawana is a Zimbabwean independent economist and a doctoral student at the Africa Research University in Zambia. He says allowing the ZiG to plunge is an adjustment toward its real value and a reflection of the real state of Zimbabwe's economy.
The value of a currency is the derivative of the productive capacity of the country. So in any case, you cannot have a stable currency if you do not have a stable economy.
Prosper Chitambara, senior economist with the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe says the decision to allow the zinc to drop could be a positive for the economy, and said a sign the central bank is allowing market forces to play more of a role in determining the value of the country's currency.
Would have some stabilizing effect on the exchange rate. I don't think it's going to have a major impact in terms of pricing on the economy, given that most businesses were already indexing their pricing, their ZIG pricing, based on the power market or based on the black market premium.
The gold-backed ZIG currency is the sixth type of currency Zimbabwe has tried in recent years. After Friday's official devaluation, the ZIG was trading at around 50 on the black market. Before Friday, it was trading at 35 to $1. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News.
The East African Court of Justice has started proceedings on a case filed by the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, against Rwanda, accusing it of violating its sovereignty and sending troops to support rebel groups in the country's eastern region. According to a statement on social media from the Tanzania-based court, DRC accuses Rwanda of acts of aggression that allegedly violate its sovereignty, territorial integrity, political stability, and independence. Zihindura Mlengwa is the president of the Center for Political and Strategic Studies in DRC and a former spokesperson for President Joseph Kabila. He tells me that he doesn't expect much from the East African Court.
Absolutely nothing. There is nothing that is going to come from that court. First of all, I'm very surprised to see the Congolese government opting for that route, because they have criticized the East African community in the past, so I don't know what they expect very much. I don't think even they expect anything. And there's absolutely nothing that is going to benefit Congo that is going to come from that, from the East African court.
DR Congo had also tried the African court on human and people's rights. And they even had thought of the International Criminal Court to speed up its investigation into Rwanda's actions in eastern DR Congo. Is this route of justice hopeful?
Well, I think justice is always good to try to seek justice, but there's not a whole lot that will come from international justice to try to help the Congolese government. You know, that's good to work public opinion, but what the Congolese government should be doing to fight back. You are not going to win such a fight with Rwanda by just going and complain everywhere and try to make your case with international justice, because even if they condemn Rwanda, they have absolutely no capacity of enforcing whatever they say. So the best thing for the Congolese government to do, and people have told them, is to fight. They need to reinforce the fighting capacity of the Congolese army. The Congolese government already has the support of the population of Congo. The population of Congo already knows that the Congolese soil or land is being attacked and invaded by Rwanda. So that has been established. What the government needs to do is fight back, and that would be the best solution.
Talking of this current one in the East African court, do you think the court, in your opinion, has jurisdiction?
Well, actually, the Congolese Senate has not yet ratified the treaty getting into the East African community. So I personally don't think they have jurisdiction, based on the fact that the Congolese government has not completed the process of joining the East African community.
Now, short of trying all these avenues through the courts, what other option is there to reconcile the two countries and solve the suffering of the people in Eastern DRC?
One thing is for Rwanda to withdraw its troops from the Democratic Republic of Congo. If Rwanda needs economic help from Congo, they should ask for it. They should not come and try to usurp power from Congo. They are acting like a bunch of bullies, you know, who think, well, because the Congolese government is weak, we can just go and take the land. Congo and Rwanda need cooperation. Just like Congo has cooperation with our neighbor Angola, Congo has cooperation with our neighbor Congo Brazzaville. And there's no problem at that front. And this is the best solution. If Rwanda can withdraw its troops, short of that, the Congolese government needs to fight back. Rwanda is such a small country, and Congo has enough resources to empower the armed forces to fight back. That's what needs to be done. And Congolese government cannot negotiate in a position of weakness. They are very weak. All they are doing is go and complain everywhere, and they are not going to do anything to Rwanda. And Rwanda will not withdraw its troops from Congo unless the Congolese government gets its act together and reinforce the capacity of the army to fight back against Rwanda. International justice is not going to bring anything to resolve the conflict between the Democratic Republic of Congo, because this is a conflict about economic resources. That's where the problem is. Rwanda wants resources from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and they want to take it by force rather than try to cooperate with the Congolese government.
Zihindra Mlengwa is the president of the Center for Political and Strategic Studies in DRC and a former spokesperson for President Joseph Kabila. He spoke with me from Kansas City. You're listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpunga in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, extremist groups with ties to Al-Qaeda or Islamic State have led to an insurgency in Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, resulting in deaths of thousands of civilians and the displacement of millions. The violence has also been a significant factor in military coups since 2020 that have swamped French and U.S. military assistance for Russian, mainly Wagner's mercenary outfit. For more insight into the implications of this military fallout, VOA's Paul Ndiho spoke with Edgar Githua, an international security and diplomatic expert at Strathmore University in Nairobi, Kenya.
The U.S. withdrawing from the Sahel region is largely because of two factors. Number one, like you rightly said, the coup d'etats. So the U.S. is a big proponent of democratic ideals. So the U.S. would not want to be seen to be operating in a theater where the government of the day is not legitimate because, you know, they have gotten power through the power of the gun. So there is that to think about. Number two, state sovereignty, the concept of sovereignty. When these countries, Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali, asked the U.S. and by extension France to withdraw, they were invoking their sovereignty. They were invoking the rights they have as sovereign countries. We control the affairs that occur in our soil. So the U.S. has got no choice but to honor the request of a sovereign country. If they do not want your help, then you have no choice but to withdraw. And two, remember, you're also withdrawing because it means leaving your troops there, you are endangering them also because they are, quote-unquote, staying in a hostile environment, in an environment where they are not needed. If you remember watching the documentaries across those three countries, people are demonstrating, we want the U.S. off, we want France off. So you do not want to leave your troops in an area where you're going to also expose them to physical harm. So the U.S. has done the right thing, in my view, in terms of obeying the concept of sovereignty and walking out because those countries have requested and told you to leave.
How about the fact that when they leave a vacuum, and we've seen in some cases where once they left, the Russians or the Wagner group took over some of those spots that were held by these armed national forces, including the United States.
Yeah, by the danger of the U.S. and by extension France, vacating and leaving the Sahel region is that power does not love vacuums. If one power leaves, another power will take that vacuum. And you've seen what the Wagner group have done. The Russians, now renamed the Africa Corps, they have come in to help or to claim to help Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger to fight the jihadists. The Wagner group have gone there. They have committed atrocities that should actually be really looked into. So what if the Sahel really has a serious debate with itself? It has replaced, quote unquote, a neo-colonial master who was benevolent to another person, even though they're not claiming they are your master, but they are really literally coming to take advantage of your weaknesses and your vulnerability. So Russia is not going to be any better in the Sahel region. Russia has proven to be a very, very unfriendly and very unreliable partner, both in security, in food security, you name it. So the Sahel will only get themselves in problems. And Paul, if you've been following news, it's recently, like a month or two ago, the Russian mercenaries who were beaten up by jihadists, mm-hmm. exactly, they were chased. So the question becomes, what military aid did they bring if they were going to be made to flee and run? Better the devil that you know than the angel you do not, because the Russians are going to be worse for the security architecture of the Sahel.
That was Edgar Githua, an international security and diplomatic expert at Strathmore University in Nairobi, Kenya, speaking with the VOA's Paul Ndiho. The UN agency that focuses on women's rights and social progress accuses Sudan's warring parties of using sexual violence as a weapon of war. UN Women says gender-based violence has increased more than twofold since the conflict erupted in mid-April of 2023. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A new report by UN Women has issued what's called a gender alert to highlight the catastrophic impacts of Sudan's conflict on women and girls. The report, which was issued Friday, finds the number of people needing gender-based violence services has doubled since the beginning of the crisis. Most of the victims are women and girls. Hoda Nadu is UN Women Regional Director for East and Southern Africa. Speaking on a video link from South Sudan, she told journalists in Geneva that intense fighting in Khartoum, Darfur, and Kordofan in particular has increased the risks of sexual violence and exploitation that women and girls face. She says nearly 6 million internally displaced women and girls are particularly vulnerable, noting that many cases of abuse go unreported because of the stigma attached. She says sexual violence is being used as a weapon of war by the Rapid Support Forces, Sudanese Armed Forces, and their allied militias.
It is a way of breaking communities. It is a way of, you know, tarnishing, you know, social fabric of a community by targeting the most vulnerable, many of them seeing their loved ones killed in front of their eyes, having seen brutal sexual violence against the children.
The UN report says the conflict is having a horrendous impact on the lives of women and children. It finds most are affected by the acute hunger gripping the country. Many of those living in households headed by women are forced to eat leaves and grass to survive. The report says women and girls are disproportionately affected by the lack of safe and easily accessible water, sanitation, and hygiene. The World Health Organization reports access to healthcare services is another challenge due to insecurity, attacks on medical facilities, and a shortage of medicines and supplies. WHO spokesperson Dr. Margaret Harris says 70 to 80% of hospitals are not functional.
Across Sudan, women are dying from pregnancy or childbirth-related complications, whether or not those pregnancies are a result of gender-based violence, whatever, women are not getting the standard care that saves your life and saves the life of your child during childbirth.
She adds children are not getting vaccinated and are dying from preventable illnesses such as measles. UN Women is calling for urgent action to protect women and girls and provide them with access to food, safe water, and sexual and reproductive health services. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
When Americans go to the polls in November, their choice between the Democratic candidate Kamala Harris and the Republican candidate Donald Trump will have ramifications for the world. However, neither candidate has offered detailed foreign policy proposals. VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi has more.
The next U.S. president will face several foreign policy challenges, especially with the Israeli-Hamas war in Gaza and the prospects of a wider conflict in the region. The U.S., France, and other allies on Wednesday called for an immediate 21-day ceasefire to allow for negotiations in the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. More than 600 people have died in Lebanon in recent days after Israel ramped up its strikes against the militant group. U.S. officials say they hope to use a three-week pause in fighting on the Lebanon-Israeli border to restart stalled negotiations for a ceasefire and hostage release deal between Israel and Hamas. Even if this effort succeeded, the next president would face the challenge of what to do after the war is over. The Democratic candidate, Vice President Kamala Harris, has called for a permanent ceasefire between Israel and Hamas militants, an independent Palestinian state, and Middle East stability. John Alterman, director of the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS, says the so-called two-state solution should be reconsidered.
To have the U.S. president talk time and time again about the importance of a two-state solution at a time when you have something like 4 out of 5 saying that doesn't get us security at all. You have to begin to address that in the two-state. I understand addressing that reality in Israeli public opinion, and that's true either of the Harris administration or Trump administration.
Alterman was speaking this week at a CSIS gathering in Washington. Former President Trump has said he previously thought the two-state solution could work, but now he isn't sure it's possible. However, he has not publicly presented an alternative. Another foreign policy challenge for the next president will be the rising influence of China and Russia on Africa. Both are rapidly increasing economic and cultural engagement with the African nations, and Russia is expanding its military support for several countries. At the CSIS event, some experts said increased U.S. diplomatic outreach on the continent in the past few years has not yet translated into enhanced ties, especially in the areas of trade, investment, and infrastructure. And they say the continent will likely remain a secondary concern in U.S. foreign policy. Cameron Hudson, a senior fellow at the Africa program at CSIS, says the state of U.S. politics helps push African countries closer to Russia and China.
This polarization in the United States has driven them to look actively for other partners. It is in now the sort of strategic document of the African Union where it has declared that the unipolar world that the United States led since the end of the Cold War has not served Africa's interests, and that going forward there must be a multipolar world to better serve African interests. And so they are actively pursuing that.
Hudson said African countries are looking for actions, not just rhetoric.
Remember that in Biden's first year in office, he announced that he was in favor of the African continent getting one UN Security Council seat. In 3 years, there's been no movement on how to do that, on how to reform the Security Council. And now as he's leaving, he's saying, okay, we're going to up it to two. The response from Africa has been, where's the plan? Where's the actual roadmap or the blueprint for how we get from this promise to reality?
Regional experts, however, say it's unclear how much either Trump or Harris would change policy on Africa, given that neither has spoken much about the continent during their campaigns. Mohammed Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
As in many other African countries, LGBTQ advocates in Eswatini are fighting an uphill battle for recognition and acceptance. Despite a Supreme Court ruling instructing the Ministry of Commerce, Industry and Trade to register a LGBTQ rights group, it has refused to do so. Reporter Nakukanye Musi looks at the perspectives of LGBTQ rights advocates and organizations and their experiences navigating legal and societal barriers.
Eswatini Sexual and Gender Minorities, an LGBTQ advocacy group, was denied registration by authorities in 2019 and even after seeking relief from the Supreme Court, which had ruled the group must be registered. Their efforts have been unsuccessful. Human rights lawyer Sibusiso Nhlabathi said the harsh legal environment for LGBTQ individuals in the Southern African Kingdom, together with the lack of recognition and protection under the law, causes significant problems.
There is the denial that they exist, so they do not have any form of protection as a group. They only rely on protection from the law or enjoyment of any right from the law as human being under chapter human beings of, under chapter 3 of our Bill of Rights, of our Constitution. So I can say it's quite challenging because there is no instrument that seeks to protect them. There is no instrument that seeks to recognize them as a group of people that exist. I don't think there is any progress that has been made.
Besides the lack of legal recognition, LGBTQ individuals in Eswatini often face discrimination in gaining access to services, high rates of intimate partner violence, and exclusion from public discussions. Sesanda Mavimbela, executive director of the Eswatini Sexual and Gender Minorities, said the idea of LGBTQ rights is considered contradictory to traditional African values and religious beliefs, perpetuating a climate of exclusion and marginalization.
Community cannot equally enjoy rights like all sources do, as per their birthright. A simple example is the one of the case of Eswatini Sexual and Gender Minorities, an organization that has been denied registration for the past 4 years. A right to associate, which is a right to all Swazis as per the constitution. And we see this happening in many cases of LGBTI where justice comes hard, sometimes not reached at all, because of what is usually quoted as non-African, unreligious, not religious or cultural.
In refusing to register Eswatini Sexual and Gender Minorities, the government cited the country's colonial era laws, which still have a profound influence on the country's legal framework. Registration for the group, also known as incorporation, would allow them to operate as a non-profit organization with the ability to, among other things, open a bank account and receive international funding. If the Ministry of Commerce, Trade and Industry continues to refuse to register ESGM despite the Supreme Court ruling, the court could issue a mandamus order, a court order that requires the government to carry out a certain action. However, no such order has been issued, and it remains to be seen if the court will do so. The ESGM filed a notice of appeal against the decision of the High Court. The appellants argue that the High Court erred in law and in fact by stating that the applicant sought to create a new breed of rights that are non-existent. On June 16, 2023, a five-panel bench of the Supreme Court of Eswatini passed a judgment setting aside the High Court's decision to dismiss ESGM's application to register as a non-profit organization. On September 27, 2023, the Minister of Commerce, Trade and Industry ordered the Registrar of Companies not to register ESGM, citing the organization's name and objectives, asserting they offend the customs and principles of Eswatini. The government of Eswatini chose to ignore the order. Despite the opposition to LGBTQ rights in Eswatini, Bishop Zwanini Shabalala, the former Secretary General of the Council of Swaziland Churches, calls for understanding and acceptance of the LGBTQI community without discrimination.
This is an area that still needs more and more dialogue in churches and in society for one to really understand the LGBTIQ community. However, that does not mean that anyone should be discriminated against. Our position as the church is that we should welcome everyone who comes to church and also advocate for access to services that are rendered by the country, from government to all other institutions, that they should also be treated like anyone else without looking at their sexual orientation.
With little to no local support, the LGBTQ community finds solace in the Eswatini offices of the European Union and the United Nations Development Programme, which provide crucial support. The EU and the US Embassy to Eswatini offered support to the LGBTQI community throughout the court proceedings between the ESGM and the local government. The UNDP also continues to run dialogue sessions and workshops. The situation remains dire, however, as the community faces a lack of recognition, acceptance, and equal rights. Nogukanyamusi, VOA News, Mbabane, Eswatini.
Yes, yes, yes. It's now time for music from African Collection. Enjoy what we have for you tonight.
bon mikoba pardon chérie ya fifi françoise et dire à paris et dire à simitanga bien yebera yena no bien bebe a capitale ngole wondo africa ngese bolo wa fifi ove libreville capitale ya gabon asil wona yebi koto melumusa fava nebya wabia bon moto. Pardon chérie, y'a ya Fifi Françoise, et il y a Paris, et il y a Jean Jaurès. Y'a Vera, y'a Nano, y'a Bébé, à Capital, on vole Wondo, Africa. Que ce pas gentil, y'a Fifi, au Brazzaville, Capital, y'a Congo. L'amour est avec la chérie Françoise. Le désir que j'ai pour toi n'a plus de frontières. Oh, 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 malheur à moi, je suis tombé dans tes bras sans réfléchir. Oh, chérie, voilà pourquoi toute ma vie avec toi je vais la finir.
And that's music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline Africa team, our engineer tonight, Said Hamdan, and our producer, Gwen Orton, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. For more African news and features, visit us on our website at viewafrica.com. Or connect with us on all social media platforms. I'm your host, Douglas Impuga in Washington. A very good evening to you all.